Tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. More than 50 million Americans suffer from allergies. It is the sixth leading cause of chronic illness in the United States. And it's something on which Americans spend a lot of money. We spend something like $18 billion coping with allergies and the symptoms that attach. Yet, in spite of the fact that there have been advances in medicine and a lot of money has been spent on research over the last half century or so, the burden of allergic disease continues to grow. So one of the questions we'll talk about this morning is, why is it that we have failed to reverse this trend? And our guest for the program is the author of a newly published book that deals with the subject of allergy. And we'll talk about that in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Greg Mittman. He is William Coleman Professor of the History of Science. He's also Professor of Medical History and Science and Technology Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he is the author of a very interesting book that has recently been published. The title is Breathing Space, How Asthma and Allergies Have Shaped the World We All Inhabit. It's published at Yale University Press and has come out recently. So if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore, perhaps in the library. And as we talk, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. One thing we'd just like to mention right up front, and I think he would underscore this, he is not a physician. So we can't take real medical questions. Obviously, if you have issues with allergies, you need to pursue this with your doctor, someone that can deal with them directly. But I think he has some very interesting things to say about allergies and the roles that they play in our lives, and certainly how the environment plays into the incidence of allergy. And that's what the book is about, and those are some of the things that we'll be talking about here this morning. Professor Mittman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It sounds like at least in some part, maybe even a large part, your interest in allergy has something to do with personal experience. You've experienced allergies, and I think that you have a child who has the same problems.
That's correct. I grew up as a severe asthmatic child in the 1960s. It was about a decade after the first really effective allergy drugs in terms of dealing with symptoms, antihistamines, bronchodilators, and steroids came on the market. And though I responded some to those drugs, I was still suffering quite severely, and there was some discussion about sending me to the Children's Asthma Research Institute and Hospital, which was probably the leading research and treatment facility for asthma in the United States, which was located in Denver. It actually grew out of a treatment called parenchymectomy, which was an idea that you needed to remove the asthmatic child from the emotional environment of the home. The 1960s was a period in which asthma was very much seen as a psychosomatic disease. And the other reason that the hospital was located in Denver was that since the late 19th century, many asthma sufferers had moved to Denver because of the climate, seeking relief in the dry mountain air. It's estimated that 30% of Denver's original population moved there because of suffering from either asthma or tuberculosis. And that really connected to my own personal history and got me interested in the larger history of allergies and the way it's really shaped American culture and life over the last century.
Well, it's a very interesting story. And maybe we'd start at the beginning talking about the fact that apparently it was the allergy as a recognized medical condition dates from, say, the early part of the 19th century, say early in the 1800s, when physicians finally said, yes, there is something here. It's distinct. It's periodic. It's not like a cold. It's something else. They apparently weren't real sure, at least at that point, what was causing it. But that, which makes me sort of wonder, I suppose my assumption was that, like the common cold, that allergies were something that plagued human beings since time immemorial. Do we have some reason to believe that that allergy has, for maybe not always, but for a long time, been part of the human experience?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, we have references to asthma going, you know, back much, much farther back even to the Greeks. But hay fever, so we have three classic allergic diseases today would be considered hay fever, allergic rhinitis, asthma, and then dermatitis. References to hay fever, as you said, really only begin in the 19th century. In England, around the 1830s, we see references to hay asthma. It was noted that the reason hay was in the title was because in England it occurred during the haying season. In the United States, we have references starting to appear in the 1850s and really increasing after the Civil War. Hay fever really begins as an upper-class disease. It's seen as largely affecting urban intellectuals and the wealthy, and it was primarily seen as a nervous disorder. That is that these urban intellectuals and upper class believed that they're were suffering from the strains and stresses of modern life, and it was affecting their nervous systems in ways that made them sensitive to the environment around them. And so one of the treatments that was quite fashionable in the late 19th century was for these wealthy hay fever sufferers to flock to what were known as hay fever resorts. In New England, it was the White Mountains area of New Hampshire. For Illinois listeners, it was primarily the northeastern shores of Lake Michigan, from Petoskey all the way up to Mackinac Island. And in fact, the reason that Ernest Hemingway spends his youth up in northern Michigan was because his father, Ed Hemingway, was a wealthy physician in Oak Park, was a hay fever sufferer, and the family would go up there for his father to escape hay fever.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my producers has roots in Petoskey, and I hadn't really talked about it with her yet, but I was happy that I was going to be able to point out to her that maybe the thing that put Petoskey on the map, so to speak, was hay fever.
It absolutely put Petoskey on the map, and, you know, Petoskey's an example of where it was a town normally during the regular season, winter, spring, there'd be maybe 4,000 residents. During the fall hay fever season, it would increase up to 40,000. So the hay fever tourist trade really established some of these tourist economies in these communities that exist today.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think is just really fascinating is this idea at this point that that hay fever was considered something that was almost a sign of refinement. It was something that sensitive people got, and it was considered to be a plague of the upper classes. And it strikes me it's kind of unusual that they would come to that kind of understanding, given the fact that it was so predictably periodical. You'd think that that might lead you to think, wait a minute, if it happens at the same time every year and for the rest of the year you're pretty much okay, you would think, well, wouldn't that tip you off to the fact that something in the environment that occurred regularly was the trigger?
Right. I mean, you're right that it's very much this seemed to be connected to refinement. It was seen as a disease of luxury in a way, something that one prided themselves in having. In fact, Henry Ward Beecher, who was one of America's most famous 19th century sufferers, said that he loved the disease too much to give up his 6-week summer holiday, because he would go to the White Mountains in mid-August. And as you say, very precise timing. Everybody knew that they had to get out of that city by about August 15th. And they would lounge in these luxurious hay fever resorts and these grand hotels until really the first frost. I mean, and one of the things, I think you could make a strong argument that the fall tourist season, for example, in New England, really begins because of the hay fever tourist trade. Many of these hotels would normally shut down in early August, but the hay fever tourists came about mid-August, and they would spend time till the first frost. We now know why they left in mid-August, and that's because when ragweed blooms, and ragweed is the leading cause of the fall hay fever season.
It was then, I think, maybe about, about 100 years later, about 100 years from the time that hay fever first, medical science first acknowledges that it's a medical condition, to the point where someone, and I think so this would have been in the early 1900s, actually starts to discover pollen and get the idea that that's what the trigger is, and that's what certainly would explain why it's periodical, and would also perhaps explain that because there are different kinds of pollen in the environment at different times, and different people are sensitive to different pollens, that it starts to become a much more complex, maybe more explainable problem, maybe not treatable, but at least explainable.
Right. It really, in the early 1900s, the first decade, 1900 to 1910, hay fever gets connected to the developing science of immunology. And the word allergy is coined by a Viennese physician, Clemens von Perquet, in 1906 to mean altered reactivity. And so by the early 1900s, one of the first allergens that is identified is pollen, and a lot of treatments are developed. One of the earliest treatments that are developed, which we still have today, are known as desensitization or immunotherapy, in which the physicians would take the offending pollens and they would dilute them down and increasingly inject larger and larger doses as a way of trying to desensitize the body to the environment around it.
Mm. I think this is also the birth of the scratch test that is still, I'm not sure if it's quite done as much as it once was, because I think now there are blood tests that you can use to do the same thing.
Right.
But the first time someone did this thing where they took the potential offending agent and they put a little scratch on people and they put some of this on their skin to see what the reaction was as a way of trying to determine what of all the various variety of things one can be allergic to were affecting that particular person.
Right, and that's really the two things that define the field of allergy as a clinical field in the early 1900s are desensitization or immunotherapy and scratch tests. And I remember as a kid, my back was like a pincushion from all the scratch tests I would have, where, you know, you would basically, as you say, survey the kind of what was in the environment of that individual, and then take an extract of that, make a scratch in the back, rub it in, and if a wheal appeared, a swelling in the skin, then you knew that that person had an allergic sensitivity to that particular substance.
So this is in a sense going back a step for a second, but for people in the 19th century before they had desensitization shots, other than taking the allergy vacation, and if you had the means, going to some place where obviously what was happening was they didn't have the plants that produced the problem that produced
Correct.
The symptom. So that's why they felt better when they went out in the piney woods, because there were no deciduous trees and not a lot of grass probably that were causing and weeds that were causing the problem. Other than taking the allergy vacation for people at that time, was there anything else that was, I'm sure there were things that people did, but I guess the question was there anything else that was truly effective?
There was nothing else that was truly effective. I mean, there were a lot of patent nostrums, you know, marketing remedies that people tried. Cocaine was something that people used. Cauterization treatments where they would actually go out and burn out the sinuses was another therapy. There's increasing number of different treatments, but none so as effective as escape. And really, as you said, it was only the wealthy that could afford to do that. And so for those that didn't have those means, they really had to suffer it out on their own.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Greg Mittman. He is William Coleman Professor of the History of Science and Professor of Medical History and Science and Technology Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of two award-winning books, many journal and scholarly articles on history of science topics, and he is the author of a recently published book that is titled Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. It's published by the Yale University Press and takes a look at the experience of allergies and how they affect human beings, how they affect the way people live, how people have understood them over time, and the various efforts to cope, from the point of where basically it was just trying to get away from whatever it was to the kinds of medications and treatments we have today. I think his argument is, one of the questions he looks at is, in spite of the fact that medical science has come some way, we still suffer from them, and our ability to deal with them is still kind of limited. We have several callers here, a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. What is it in wheat where people get the reaction from? Products.
Right. It raises a whole nother issue that I don't deal with very much at all in the book, and that's food allergies. And so food allergies are another area. I mean, already in the 1920s, physicians were recognizing that certain foods seemed to cause an allergenic reaction, or people were sensitive to. Some of the earliest were strawberries, but wheat also. So it's different, can be different proteins within food structures. Peanuts, for example, we know of, you know, can cause severe anaphylactic shock in some allergy sufferers. But it's a protein response. So it's some kind of configuration of a protein in this case of a particular food.
And then finally, in terms of with air pollution, increasing air pollution, what impact does that have, or what is that sort of a catalyst to a certain degree?
Well, we know that air pollution can be an exacerbating factor in the case of asthma. There's a lot of debate about whether it can be a causative factor, but we know that, for example, in the case of asthma, where there are significant health disparities, so particularly in the inner city among poor communities of color, where asthma rates, death rates and hospitalization rates are 3 to 5 times the national average. In places like Harlem, 25% of African American children have asthma. We know that air quality and air pollution is a contributing factor in those disparities.
Thank you.
All right,
let's
talk with someone in Mattoon. This is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question regarding sensitivity and allergies as you age. In my 30s and 40s, I seem to get hay fever all the time each year. But as I've grown older, I don't have hay fever near as bad. As a matter of fact, some falls I don't have it at all. And with food allergies, for example, severe allergy to eggs, I just wonder, as you get older, do you get less sensitive to these things, or is there any studies on that?
It's an interesting question. One of the things we know is that, from your own experience, is that people's sensitivity can change over their life history, and so it's not uncommon for people to go through periods where their allergies are less severe, but they may come back. So it kind of fluctuates with one's life history, and it's not clear, you know, what are the causes that can account for that.
I just wonder, do you hate to experiment on things with food allergies too much? I just curious if there was anything on the food allergies, but on the hay fever, why, it seems pretty obvious to me that I am a lot less sensitive, which is good news.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Greg Mittman. He's a professor of history of science, and it looks at allergies from not quite so much from the medical point of view, but more from a kind of an historical point of view, from an environmental point of view, talking about the ways that they intersect with and influence the way that we live. So certainly questions are welcome. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that initially the idea was, particularly with hay fever, that it was somehow just a response. What people were responding to was the stresses and strains of their life, and that it was people, generally this was something that was seen to affect upper-class people, professional people, probably a lot of doctors, lawyers, people in public life, people who were important or thought that they were that were very busy, highly stressed people, and it was thought to be a reaction to that. They were just very sensitive, they were stressed out, and for the people who could do it, the best way they had to deal with their symptoms of when things were worst, leave town. Go out and spend several weeks in some nice resort place, which I'm sure was quite pleasant for them. Yeah. Once you get to the point though where the triggers were started to be better understood, the fact that what was going on here was people were reacting to plants in the environment, really, with hay fever, with asthma. Then was the time when people really declared war on weeds. They realized, okay, there were particularly certain plants that were a problem, like ragweed, for example. And so then the kind of emphasis shifts, or we get this concentration on, here's a plant, it's a problem, well, let's go out there and get rid of the plants.
Right. I mean, as you've pointed to, there's a kind of different ways of dealing with allergies. The first is being escaped, fleeing to these hay fever resorts or to western towns such as Denver and Tucson. The second part, as you mentioned, as these allergens, different allergens become visible, particularly as ragweed becomes one of the known contributing factors for the fall hay fever season, there is an attempt to treat the disease by modifying the environment around us. And we see that quite clearly with ragweed beginning in the 1920s and 1930s. Ragweed is a native North American plant. It flourishes in disturbed soils. And so during the 1920s and 1930s, it starts to make its appearance in particularly in urban vacant lots, and we see widespread campaigns to try and get rid of ragweed within the city. So in the 1930s, for example, in New York City, the Works Progress Administration put to work unemployed men to try and root out, just weed out all the ragweed in the city. And so they would cover these blocks where there were urban vacant lots where there was ragweed present and just would pull it up by the roots. By the 1940s, a new weapon on this war on ragweed becomes available, and that's the herbicide 2,4-D. And we see massive, widespread community campaigns spraying the herbicide on roadsides and vacant lots to try and eliminate ragweed, as though we could somehow, through this science and technology, be able to eradicate the landscape of ragweed and also reduce the burden of allergic disease. Of course, it doesn't work. But it shows the kind of technological optimism very much prevalent in American culture in the 1950s, that somehow through better chemistry, through science and technology, we would really be able to eliminate disease through new drugs like antibiotics or through things like the herbicide 2,4-D and eliminating ragweed. And yet it doesn't work, and it ended up backfiring in some ways.
Mm. It's also interesting that around this point here, given that there was this earlier focus on the idea that hay fever was something that only people of the upper classes got, that hay fever and maybe not so much hay fever, but asthma particularly, reactive airway problems was something that was really related very closely to the quality of the environment in the place where you lived. And so we started to become much more sensitive to that, to people who were living in the worst circumstances. Obviously, their environmental conditions were bad. People living in cities, air quality was bad. There could be all kinds of problems. And that here now we start to see that there actually was, we start to see these being not something that was considered to be a problem of the wealthy, but something that was particularly a problem for the most disadvantaged.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I became quite interested in is most public health officials and physicians would trace the current urban asthma epidemic to the 1980s. And as I started digging into the history of allergy and asthma in America, much to my surprise, one of the things that I found was that this urban asthma epidemic, which is really afflicting poor inner city communities, goes back to the 1950s. And we see this first wave of urban asthma in cities like New York, Chicago, New Orleans, where increasing numbers of poor African Americans and Puerto Ricans living in these communities were going into emergency rooms in the case of Charity Hospital, for example, which is located in New Orleans. They were getting upwards of 200 admissions a day for asthma, where the normal number would have been 25. And it became so common in New Orleans that it was known as the fifth season. At first, because allergy had really been, and asthma had been seen as kind of primarily a white middle upper class disease, at first physicians and public health officials didn't know really what to look for. And one of the shocking things that I found was that during the 1950s and particularly during the early 1960s, that physicians started to blame this initial wave of urban asthma among African Americans and Puerto Ricans on the emotional unrest of the civil rights movement, again, connecting to this notion of asthma as a psychosomatic disease.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually people began to look at other contributing factors in the city, such as air quality, such as poor housing conditions, inadequate access to health care, all of which I argue in the book combine to make a particular population vulnerable to allergic diseases like asthma in the ways that other populations are not.
We have a couple of other callers here who would like to join in the conversation. We'll go next to talk with someone in Champaign, and this would be someone on line one. Hello.
Yeah, action, your conversation. What about the impact of pesticides and herbicides? Is that on allergies? Does it have an impact?
It's a really interesting question, and very few people are looking at that. Just as an example, in the case of thinking about asthma in the inner city, one of the things that people have focused on are cockroach allergen. The feces of cockroaches are highly allergenic, and in terms of the exacerbating factors in asthma, cockroach allergen is identified early on as an important factor. What people aren't looking at, though, is the amount of pesticides that are sprayed within cities to deal with pests like cockroaches. And so in Manhattan, there is more pesticide sprayed than in all of the agricultural counties of New York City combined. And what the links are between pesticides exposure and children health within these urban communities is something we really don't know very much about.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in McLean County. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning. My question is about asthma and allergies. In your work, have you seen if there's any connection between having allergies, would that lead to asthma, or vice versa?
Well, the majority of people that have asthma, about 70%, are caused by allergenic factors. So there are asthmatics that where it's not allergenic induced, but a lot of asthma is triggered through allergy.
So allergy can lead to or develop into asthma?
Can.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Again, let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580, Greg Mittman. He's an historian. He's professor of the history of science. He's also professor of medical history and science and technological studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's the author of the book Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. It is published by the Yale University Press. We talked about the fact that at one time, the best advice that was given to people who had asthma, had allergies, was to move, essentially, either to take allergy vacations, which means at the time that your symptoms are worst, go to some place where you feel better. And some people could do that. Not everybody could, but some people could do that. And, of course, there was the advice that some people, it would be better if they just relocated completely. And that is why people, a lot of people who lived in the eastern part of the country ended up moving to places like Arizona, because it was supposed to be more healthful for them. But for people who really couldn't do either of those, when that wasn't an option, technology did come along, at least in the form of air filtration for the home, and then air conditioning, so that what people could do was, in a sense, try to deal with the problem by getting it out of at least the immediate home environment. Of course, that maybe went on to create some other problems, but at least initially, that was something that was offered as assistance to people who were experiencing the symptoms.
Yes, allergy sufferers really actually helped open up the market for air conditioning. When air conditioning first became available in the 1920s, it was very, very expensive. Only the most wealthy could afford it within their homes. The way in which people experienced air conditioning was primarily in public places like motion picture palaces. So in the 1920s, motion picture theaters would advertise that they had air conditioning as a way of trying to attract the public during the summer, when it was a kind of downtime in terms of the movie-going experience. And we actually have references to people suffering from allergies who really try and organize their whole life around being in public air-conditioned spaces, so they would get jobs as ushers at motion picture theaters and so forth, because they found relief. And the initial kind of medical market, if you will, for air conditioning was for allergy sufferers. In fact, you could get a tax break from the government if you were an asthma sufferer and wanted to put air conditioning in your home. By the 1950s, as costs are reduced, we get increasing numbers of Americans introducing air conditioning into their home. But one of the things that happens is in the more and more people are spending more and more time indoors. We spend about 90% of our time indoors now. And in the 1970s, with the OPEC oil embargo, we started shifting towards more tight building construction to reduce energy costs within the home. And that reduced the amount of ventilation and air circulation within the home. It increased moisture levels within the home. And all of a sudden in the 1980s, one of the things that we see are an increasing visibility of indoor allergens, such as dust mites, which thrive under higher humidity concentrations. Secondhand tobacco smoke is a really significant factor in the case of asthma. Other kinds of indoor air pollutants, such as the gassing of urea formaldehyde insulation, which was spent to try and reduce energy costs, and gassing of carpets. So all of these combined make the home as much a kind of ecological nightmare than a safe haven.
Yeah, just an interesting example of how our attempts to solve one kind of problem can end up creating a different kind of problem.
Right, and one of the arguments in the book is that we're always trying to search for the next magic bullet, a kind of single technological fix, and it often leads to these unintended environmental consequences.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Again, we have someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to dispel a myth or check it out. Ragweed comes to head at the same time as goldenrod, and often goldenrod is accused of being an allergenic.
And it's not.
That's what I believe. So that tidies that one up. Another one I would say to you is that ragweed, people can get rid of it, but they should cut it. They should not pull it up because there are a million ragweed seeds down there. So if you do happen to pull a ragweed up, you put your hoof down and tighten it up so the seed is in very hard soil so it won't have as good an opportunity to grow again.
Right.
Another one that I was interested in is, as people went to Arizona, it seemed to me like they took their mulberries and all sorts of other things that may or may not have been allergenic. Is that a? Do you notice that people took their vegetation with them and thereby took some of their allergies?
Yes, in fact, I talk about this in the book Breathing Space, where in the 1920s, Tucson really started to advertise itself as the health and climate capital of the world, particularly for health seekers suffering from asthma, arthritis. By the 1950s, approximately 30% of Tucson's population are health seekers going to the desert for therapeutic relief. But as you mentioned, one of the things that happens is a lot of these people come from the Northeast. And we, you know, are most often comfortable in the environments we grow up in, and they were not very keen on the desert landscape. And so one of the things that happens is they plant lawns of Bermuda grass, which is a highly allergenic species. They bring in trees, as you mentioned, mulberry trees and olive trees to create shady streets. Also allergenic species, and by the 1970s, pollen loads in Tucson had increased twofold, and by the late 1970s and early 1980s, partly because of people moving there, but partly because of the changes in the environment, the rates of asthma in Tucson were twice that of the national average, and hay fever 6 to 9 times that of the national average. So it's, again, one of these stories of unintended environmental consequences.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll talk with someone next in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. My question, well, I have two of them. First, what time of the year is pine pollen a problem?
It would depend on the area, geographic area. I mean, for example, in the southeast, it's spring. I mean, most of the trees are, it's spring or early spring. For tree allergies.
Okay. And also, what difference in susceptibility to poison ivy is there with different ethnic groups?
I don't know the answer to that question. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As we continue to talk in this part of Focus 580 with our guest historian, Greg Mittman from University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of the book Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes, published by Yale University Press. Kind of a history of allergy and our attempts to deal with it. And not exactly a medical look at it, but perhaps more of an historical, sociological kind of look. Questions, though, are certainly welcome. At some point here, we get to the age where we, in the past, there were various kinds of nostrums and folk remedies and things that people tried to deal with their symptoms, but weren't terribly effective. Now we come to the time where we have things like decongestants and antihistamines and inhaled steroids, and we have all kinds of medications available with and without prescription to treat the symptoms of allergy. They don't really get rid of the problem, but I suppose what they have done is it made it for some people at least a little bit easier to live with the symptoms.
Yes. I mean, if we look at these different kind of historical periods, we, you know, have this period, the initial period of kind of escape, and the second really modifying the environment around us through the spraying of ragweed or creating air-conditioned environments. And really the last phase, which is what we're in now, is changing the interior environment of the body through drugs to, so that we can kind of ignore the environment around us. And the development of allergy drugs becomes really big business after the Second World War. The first antihistamine that's developed is in 1946, Benadryl, which is, you know, still on the market.
Still around,
today.
Yeah.
And by the 1950s, antihistamines were the third most prescribed drug in America, third only to antibiotics and barbiturates. During the 1980s, we see the allergy and asthma market really opening up for the pharmaceutical industry. It was one of the fastest growing markets. And a second generation of antihistamines becomes available by the early 1990s. And so many of your listeners might be familiar with Claritin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Claritin, which was one of the first second generation antihistamines, these were newer antihistamines that didn't have quite the sedative effects such as Benadryl that some people experienced, made Schering Plough $15 billion between 1992 and 2003. In the case of asthma drugs, again, we see huge money being made there. GlaxoSmithKline, 20% of its $32 billion in worldwide pharmaceutical sales in 2005 came from just two asthma drugs, Flovent and Advair.
We have somebody else here to talk with. Again, another caller. Let's go to them. Cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question from a historical perspective. I've often heard it said that if you eat honey from local areas that you're having the allergies from, where the bee would be picking up the pollens from the different allergy-producing plants, that it helps desensitize an individual to those allergens. Is there any historical evidence for that?
I don't have any evidence in terms of effectiveness. I mean, what it opens up is this, a whole range of alternative therapeutics that people have tried, and particular alternative diets. One of the things that we see happening is allergy is always kind of been construed as a malady of civilization and modern life. And after the Second World War, with the flood of chemicals being introduced into the environment, with the flood of additives to food, some allergists began to argue that allergy was actually, the growing increase of allergy was a response to all these chemicals in the environment, and try to approach it through food and diet. Although many of our ideas were kind of marginalized by the mainstream medical community, but there's a whole range of alternative therapeutic treatments and theories that people consult today.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Line two is next. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, I'm really interested in what you've been discussing about how race and class affect people's experiences with allergies, and I'm wondering if you found any evidence of gender having some effect on the same thing, especially in the late 19th century, and how women's bodies were maybe seen as more vulnerable to allergies or to other diseases.
Yeah, interesting. There is definitely a gender component, although in the case of hay fever, it was primarily seen to afflict males, and it had a kind of notion of effeminacy, that is, modern civilized life was making men more feminine, and they needed to go out in nature and adopt a kind of rugged lifestyle to overcome their asthma or hay fever. A classic example of that is Teddy Roosevelt, who grew up as a severe asthmatic child. And, you know, he goes out and becomes a Western rancher, and through that process of leading the rugged life, allegedly is able to overcome his asthma. One of the things, though, that we do see is in the 1950s, a marketing of the these new allergy drugs, particularly to women, where allergy was seen as an occupational hazard of the home, and particularly women dusting, and house dust was a known allergen. And so you see a lot of ads being targeted at women who primarily were homemakers, and arguing that, for example, dusting, cleaning the home was an occupational hazard and that they needed to take these new allergy drugs.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll come back here for another call or someone in Normal, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Did you do any looking at any global comparative data, either over time or space, so to speak, which may shed some light on whether America is a peculiarly asthmatic country? And secondly, is there anything to the claim that coal fire plants have some correlation with asthma?
Interesting. A little bit in terms of the global reach. You know, asthma and allergies have largely seen to afflict the developed world, and so in Europe and the United States, where the incidences are highest. But we've also seen some recently that the increases in the rise among developing nations. One of the things that I think plays into that is there's a kind of masking effect of diseases. So as diseases like TB, for example, in the United States decline, we see asthma become more visible. And so there's a kind of masking effect of one disease over another. One of the other things about, in terms of the global reach, is we know that global climate change can have an impact on pollen-bearing plants like ragweed. Ragweed, which was originally native only to North America, has spread throughout Europe. It's now in China. And we know from laboratory and field studies that with increasing CO2 levels and with increasing temperatures, the amount of pollen produced by ragweed significantly increases, and interestingly, some of the allergenic properties of that pollen also seem to become more severe. So it's very much allergies are also connected to global warming. In terms of coal-fired plants, there again, I mean, it really links to issues of air pollution and particulates. We know, as I said, that it can be an exacerbating factor. The jury's still out to what extent air pollution is actually a causative factor in illnesses like asthma.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It seems that if you take a look at what it is now we have to offer people who have severe symptoms, a lot of what we have now, it's the same stuff we've had. Either we say, try to do what you can to prevent your exposure to the allergen. We still do have allergy shots, so that desensitizing strategy is still used.
Right.
And we have various kinds of drugs that are designed to prevent the allergic response, and we still have antihistamines, and we still have steroids, and we have some better medications that now people are using to try to block that reaction. But it seems that we haven't gotten very much further from that. Is there some idea that perhaps that at some point we'll understand what's going on, to the point that not only can we just say, well, this is how the body is reacting, but we actually have some way to deal with it?
Well, I mean, we see the research to try and target more and more upstream in the kind of immunological reaction. So in the immune response, one of the things that's involved in the allergenic reaction is the increased presence of an antibody known as IgE, and it's in heightened levels in allergenic sufferers, and it helps trigger this whole cascade of chemical reactions that leads to the runny noses and sniffling and so forth. So we see increasingly attempts to kind of really go upstream in terms of the chemical reaction to try and target that. But that kind of focus, I think, really has led us in some ways down the wrong path. And what one of the arguments I make in the book is that we need to really approach these diseases more ecologically and really look at the way in which illness is an outcome of economic, social, and environmental relationships that come together and affect particular people in particular ways. And so rather than kind of putting all our eggs in one basket in terms of developing better drugs that are always sold to us as the next magical cure, which never pans out, that we really need to take an integrated approach that addresses not only, you know, the kind of interior environment of the body, but the environment around us, and approaching that in a more kind of community health, public health perspective. We've really eroded public health approaches in this country as we've really become more and more a kind of nation that approaches healthcare through just drugs. And I think we really need to get back more towards a public health perspective.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting book. And again, for people who are interested in exploring this subject further, look for the book. The title is Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. It's the Yale University Press, and the author, our guest, Greg Mittman, is William Coleman Professor of the History of Science and also Professor of Medical History and Science and Technology Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And Professor Mittman, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Pines Plus Waterscapes and Nature's Way Incorporated, now carrying neem oil, a naturally organic product with many uses around the home. Information on neem oil is at Pines Plus Waterscapes, Champaign, 355-2266, or Nature's Way Incorporated in Effingham, 800-369-1247.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's 10:58 Central Time. I'm Jeff Bossert with this update on the markets. First, take a look at Kansas City September wheat. It's at 6.649, and it's up 1.5. December wheat at 6.64, up 1.25. On the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat at 6.64 unchanged. December at 6.83.5 unchanged. September corn at 3.30¾ up 5. December corn at 3.47¾ up 4¾. March 3.63 up 3¾. August soybeans at 8.36. Up 10. The September at 8.42½, up 8¾. November at 8.59, up 9. August soybean meal at 2.23.50, up 2.80. August soybean oil at 36.70, up 16. August feeder cattle at 115.65, that's down 60. August live cattle at 92.87½, down 50. October at 97.32½, down 37½. August lean hogs at 75.15. That's up 57½. At this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is at 13,447.48, down 21.30. The NASDAQ at 25,44.96, down 2.37. Stay tuned next hour in the program Focus 580, an archive from June. David Inge's guest will be Nathan Tublitz, the co-chair of the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics and professor of neurobiology at the University.